Welcome. Today I'm speaking to Emma Cooper, and this is the final day of Emma's virtual book tour to promote her fascinating ebook called Jade Pearls and Alien Eyeballs. In Jade Pearls, you'll meet some people who seek out unusual fruits and vegetables and push the boundaries of their plot to breaking point by trying to grow crops out of their natural habitat or those that have resisted commercial cultivation. They include Alice Fowler, Martin Crawford of the Agroforestry Research Trust, and Mark Diacono of Otter Farm, and even me. Emma has persuaded them to share their passion with you, and you'll see amazing plants through their eyes. And for those of you who catch the bug, Jade Pearls has profiles of some less common crops that you can try in your own garden. Easy, unusual edibles that will grow alongside your usual fruit and veg. And for those of you that don't know Emma, she's an experienced author, photographer, writer, and podcaster. Emma wrote The Alternative Kitchen Garden and A to Z, which got me interested in this field, and also The Allotment Pocket Bible and Growing Vegetables is Fun. Emma also has an audiobook published, which I've reviewed on my website, called The Peat-Free Diet, and I strongly recommend that. Emma's also an ethnobotanist, having recently completed her master's degree at Canterbury University. Emma's also a friend and a very welcome visitor to Legg Towers. Welcome, Emma.
Thank you. Wow, what an introduction. You've made me sound awesome.
Because you are. Well, this has been a bit of a tour, Emma. You've been all over the world on the tour, to the Far East and around the UK as well.
Yeah.
Any highlights of the tour?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody's been wonderful. I've been, you know, sort of hopping across people's blogs all across the world. It's just been an amazing experience. Two of my friend bloggers have hosted me reading from the book, which is very exciting. And some people who have done pictures and Q&As and interviews. I think one of my favourites was somebody that I met on Twitter did a review of the book. And it's a nice review in and of itself. She posted one of the photos, my author photos that I've done for the book, where I'm wearing my pith helmet to look like a great explorer. And she, one of the commenters on her blog said that she saw this picture of me and she found it very reassuring because I look really, I can't remember quite what she said, but I look, you know, funny and, you know, as if, she said that I look completely normal. And then she realised that I couldn't be completely normal because of the title of the book. And then she went on to read the review and decided that, you know, I wasn't completely normal, but it sounded like a great book anyway.
On the front of the book, Emma Cooper, not quite normal.
Yeah, weird in the right ways. turn that into a positive. Weird in the right ways. Yeah, so that was hilarious. So yeah, the virtual book tour has been a really great experience, and you can see all of the stops along the way on my blog. There are links to everything if you want to go and see it and see all of the wonderful people who have hosted me. I'm very grateful to all of them.
It's well worth it, actually, because what I enjoyed when I was preparing for the interview was looking through all those. And you see the book through many different sets of eyes, but also lots of different perspectives from where the different people are coming from.
You did. Even when people were asking me questions, they all asked different questions, which was absolutely fascinating, because you'd think that there would be sort of a standard set of questions, but there wasn't. And only, in fact, one person asked me what the title of the book meant. Everybody else just went, okay.
Okay, well, let's do that then. If that's only been done once, what does the title of the book mean? What's the significance?
Jade Pearls and Alien Eyeballs are common names for two of the plants in the book, in actual fact. Jade Pearls is a translation of one of the Chinese names for Chinese artichokes. It reflects what they look like in the soil. Lots of people say that they look like fat white grubs, which is utterly revolting. But the Chinese think they look like jade pearls, and that sounds much more appetizing to me, so that's the one that I choose. Alien Eyeballs is a name that I gave myself to a plant that I call paracress, but which James Wong refers to as electric daisies, because they make your mouth tingle. But they have these amazing flowers that stand upright on stems, and they're just this spherical yellow with a red spot in the middle, and they just look like alien eyeballs. So you've got these things in the garden. They'd be a great plant for kids, but that's And so when I was went through a lot of potential titles for the book, and that was just the one that captured my imagination. I just wanted to say, you know, these are unusual plants.
Well, it's striking.
Yeah, exactly.
And it really gives the impression of what the book's about, because there's some real unusual edibles in there. There's some really quite out of the way things that most allotment and garden gardeners won't have seen.
Yeah, and I think it gives you the right impression of the book, because I could have had a stuffy title saying, "Oh, these are the unusual plants you could grow in your garden," but it's not a stuffy book, so that might have, you know, people might have, it might have missold it a little bit. It's it's not an entirely serious book.
Okay, well, then thinking about the edibles that are in there, and you've sampled a good number of them. What's your top three that you like the most to eat?
Ah, well, I'm not entirely sure. I'm not that great at eating them. I really, really try. But my gardening life has been very, very disrupted over the last few years. And so I set out at the beginning of the year with the best of intentions to grow these plants. And I do grow them, but they don't always make it into the kitchen. Or you just like have a quick nibble and then life gets in the way. So I'm not an expert on what all of these things taste like. People always say, "What are they like?" And I'm not entirely sure. So I'm still working on that. It's a work in progress. I think one of my personal favourites is a chocha, which is a vining plant that grows these oddly shaped, they're a little bit like green peppers in flavour, but they don't have that sort of acid taste to them. I mean, you've grown them yourself, so yeah. You know. And they are great in a huge variety of things. Last time I had them, we just chopped them into risotto, and they just work fine as a green vegetable. So that's one of my favourites, and a very easy one to incorporate into a diet.
I think the very young ones taste a bit like cucumber.
People say that. I don't really see it, but that might be because I'm not the world's biggest fan of cucumber.
Right.
So maybe my brain's just going, no, they're not like cucumber at all. You can eat them.
So I use them. I make a lot of like bread and butter pickles with them. So chocha with courgettes and onions in a vinegar. And they're very good for that. They're great as a something next to cheese, or to have with a drink before a meal, like as an antipasto.
Yeah.
And I know Charlie Hicks, who's the veg man, I sent him some of my achocha down, and he did them like padron peppers. So fried them and coated them in sea salt, and had those as like an antipasto as well.
Yeah, I mean, the traditional way to cook them in their homeland in the Andes is to stuff them like stuffed peppers. But I think probably they're talking about a slightly larger variety than the standard one we get here, which are these sort of, they're only about an inch long, so you'd have to be quite adept at stuffing.
A taxidermist ought to be good at that sort of thing.
Yeah, so that might push the boundaries of my culinary expertise just a little bit.
And they get a bit more woody when they get larger as well, don't they? They're best young.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I really do want to try, and I might this year because I've got some seedlings, with the alien eyeballs. We in this country tend to grow them for the flowers, and they make your mouth fizz. Right. In actual fact, it's quite an interesting experience. I had Dave Hamilton, who writes about foraging, in my garden, and I thought, he likes foraging. He's bound to be up for trying this plant, which I hadn't at that point tried myself. Being a little bit more nervous, and so I thought he'll be great, he won't mind. So we just picked the flowers off this plant, and Dave being Dave, he popped a whole flower in his mouth and just chomped down, and me being a little bit more ladylike, I was just like nibbling at the edges, and it does exactly what it says on the tin. It makes your mouth tingle and fizz, and it's quite an amazing sensation. And then it goes slightly numb, but not unpleasantly. But what it also does, and which I may have neglected to mention to Dave when we did this, was that it helps produce saliva in your mouth. So after chomping down on this flower, for the next 5 minutes, Dave is going around my garden spitting everywhere. So I think maybe next time I try and introduce him to one of my unusual edibles, he might be a little bit more cautious.
Absolutely. Do you know what was in the plant that causes that?
I don't actually. I need to find out. Anyway, this wasn't where this story was going. It's just an amusing anecdote. But in its homeland, which I think is South America somewhere, I think it might be Brazil, it's the leaves that they use, and they use them as a flavouring for things like beef stew. And I really, really, really want to try that this year.
Ah, right.
And see, you know, have a more sensible use for this plant, other than making your guests spit all over the garden.
It'd be a great one to put into a salad for relatives, wouldn't it? And watch your granny go away afterwards.
I'm not sure my mother would ever come round again.
Excellent. And we did an ocker pizza the other day.
Yeah.
And have you done one or done something similar?
I haven't, because my ochre are sprouting, so that I need to plant them. And in actual fact, my crop did very badly last year because I planted them very late and then they got too hot and too dry.
Right.
So I'm going to try that this autumn because I'm going to look after them much better this year. So everybody who reads your blog will know what ochre are.
Yep.
These sort of Andean tubers.
Yep.
Everybody says they're a little bit like potatoes, but they come in stunning colours.
Yeah, I think they're like jewels. Like if you were in a computer game, they'd be the jewels that you pick up as a prize, wouldn't they?
And they give you energy as well. That's a perfect analogy.
Indeed.
The ochre power-ups.
Now, I like them a lot. And I don't think they taste anything like potatoes.
They don't. They really don't.
And they've got a texture when they're not quite tender. It's a bit like blimey, what's it? Not bamboo shoots. Chinese. What am I thinking of? water chestnuts. That's it.
Oh,
water chestnuts. It came to me. Hooray!
They do have that kind of crunch if they're not.
They do. Yeah.
Yeah. So the advantage of them over potatoes is you can eat them if they're.
Yeah.
You don't have to cook them to eat them. They won't kill you. You'd have to eat a lot of raw potato for that to kill you, but it wouldn't make you feel very well.
No, indeed. No, so they're well worth it. Have you had a disaster edible?
Oh, yes.
Good. Oh, let's talk disasters.
Yeah, because disasters are always funny, aren't they? In actual fact, I'm trying them again this year. With a different variety that I have very kindly been sent from Canada. One of my contacts in Canada, a nice lady called Telsing, has tiger nuts.
All right.
And the history of them in this country is that I've read that they were used in the Second World War in place of sweets. So they're supposed to be sort of slightly chewy, slightly sweet, tiny little tubers that you dig up from under the plant, and they're just yummy. And in actual fact, in Spain, they're used quite a lot. They're ground down into a powder and used for a drink called horchata, which is very famous in Spain. And a few years back, I tried them. And they grow in pots. They're leafy plants. And in actual fact, they're related to papyrus.
Ah.
And they like being grown in damp soil. So I had them in pots and I looked after them all summer, as I do, which is not very well because I'm rubbish at watering things. And so at the end of the summer, I tipped out this pot and I painstakingly went through and I picked out all the tiger nuts, and they grew. That wasn't the problem. The problem was when you put one in your mouth, it was like chewing gravel. They had this horrible, horrible texture and they weren't sweet at all. And I'm just like, I don't get it. I really don't get it. Telsing had this photo on Facebook of hers, and they were bigger and they just looked that bit juicier, and they looked like they might actually be kind of tasty.
Right.
So she has very kindly sent me, and I'm going to try them again this year. But no, that was a bit of a disaster.
So they do need plenty of water by the sounds of it.
I'm not sure whether that was the problem or not. We will find out. But I mean, when you go down this road of unusual edibles, you do have to expect some failures. I tried to grow chayote, which grow very well in New Zealand, and you can buy them over here. They're big fruits, about, I don't know, about the size of a dog's ball. And some of them are very, very...
You mean the ball he plays with?
The ball it plays with, right. Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. Okay. And some of them are smooth skin. They look like an ugly apple. But some of them are really, really spiny. And I was given a couple that were really, really spiny. And the thing with chayote is the seeds only germinate inside the fruit. You can't store the seed. So you have to plant this whole fruit. So I donned my very thick gardening gloves. It's like repotting a cactus. Carefully planted these two things up. And you start in December and they just very slowly start sending out this shoot from the top. And then, of course, when it does, you have to repot it into a bigger pot. You do this several times. Eventually, it went outside in the garden. And it started growing really, really nicely. But the problem with chayote is that they are day-length sensitive. And I had read this book that this guy somewhere down south had said that it works for him because he puts it in a half-shaded location, so it gets effectively shorter days than you would normally. So I tried that, but mine was just complete and utter failure. The plants just sulked. I think one of them did eventually produce a flower and a tiny little fruit, and it just aborted. And at the end of the year, I was just left with these two half dead plants, and I'm just like, oh, that was very disappointing. So you do get that.
And that's part of the joy of growing the unusual edibles, isn't it? It's having to experiment with mimicking the conditions that they grow in their natural habitat.
Yeah, and the trial and error. There is a lovely story that when they brought the water lily, first brought the water lily over to this country, nobody could get one to grow. And I think it was, in actual fact, just a gardener on somebody's big estate that they had back then. He just tried and he tried and he tried. And eventually he was the one who hit the magic combination of how these things grow in this country, sort of temperature and day length and whatever. And it is that you need that spirit and determination to experiment and just not give up. I try too many different things. I need to stick to one or two.
Yeah. I think we certainly find that a problem here is being interested in so many and trying to grow so many that means that you can spread yourself a bit thin and you don't give things the attention that they deserve sometimes to be successful.
Yeah. That's very true, yes. Especially when you're trying to grow all the regular things as well.
Yeah.
That are a little bit easier. Yeah, you have to be a little bit determined.
And I think one of the joys of the unusual edible field, if you'll excuse the pun, which is highlighted by Jade Pearls, is the number of enthusiasts that there are, but also how helpful and how many of them are quite happy to make a contribution in terms of their knowledge or even plant material. And you say something about that in the book, don't you?
I do, yes. The people that are mentioned in the book, and a lot of them are, you know, amateur gardeners, amateur plant breeders. They are just so generous with their knowledge, and a lot of them share it on the internet. And you can just go along, you can ask them a question, and they'll answer it. It's not a problem at all. And quite often, if you want a plant that you can't get hold of anywhere else, they will send you seeds or cuttings or whatever. They are very generous people.
It is definitely. I mean, a lot of the stuff that both you and I grow comes from that source, and similarly we both send a lot of stuff out, and it's lovely to see your progeny going out into the world and other people having fun with them.
I think it is. I think Owen Smith must be single-handedly responsible for 90% of the people growing ochre in this country.
Indeed, he's a dealer.
Yeah, he's my ochre dealer. He's out of the shadows now and into the limelight, bless him.
Excellent. Well, let's think about that then. If you had a dinner for edible hunters, or hunters of edibles, past or present, who would you have, Emma? Who would be your ideal dinner party guests?
Well, I was thinking about this, and I think I'm not really into hero worship, so I think I would like to stick to the present.
Okay.
And I would like to have... I would like to be able to invite everybody who's in the book to one big meal. And for a location, I'd like to take them all to Stephen Barstow's garden in Norway.
Yeah.
Because not only does he have a vast collection of unusual edible plants, and you'd never, ever get me out of there.
Yeah.
excuse me. But he is the very spirit of what this is about, because he gardens in Norway. He's up near the Arctic. He gets very cold winters. Everything's buried in snow. The sun disappears completely for weeks on end. And I think he also gardens on a slope. And you just think, if this man can produce, you know, unusual edibles of all ilks in Norway, and I think he harvests something from his garden every day of the year, pretty much. Like, he has a few plants he forces in the basement. If he can do that, then somebody with a sizable flat backyard in the nice temperate UK has really got no excuses.
Yeah. It is quite incredible how he grows the range of stuff that he does.
He is. He's absolutely fascinating. And I am so looking forward to his book, which is coming out very soon now, I hope.
Yes,
which
it is, yeah.
I think it's called Around the World in 80 Plants.
No, that's going to be fascinating. And it's going to be lovely to see an insight from through his eyes of how he does what he does.
Yes. Alice Fowler went to visit him for her book, one of her books, The Edible Garden, I think. I am so jealous. She's amazing.
Well, she did a film. Do I remember seeing something on television?
Yes, I think you're right. It's a few years ago now, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yes, I think she took a cameraman along, and they both went. And you've just got to hate them now, haven't you?
Well, one day perhaps we'll get an invite. What do you reckon? Do you think anyone would be taking any notice of this?
Yeah, Stephen, are you listening? We'd like to. And visit. I'm sure we'd be very welcome, actually.
Now, what would you have on the menu?
What would I have on the menu? Lots of things that I've never been able to try, I think. I'd like to try salep, which is in this country, a very old-fashioned thing. Which
How do you spell that, Emma?
S-A-L-E-P.
S-A-L-E-P. I've never heard of that.
It's basically a starch that's made from orchid tubers.
Crikey.
I know. And it used to be quite a common thing here. But now we have, you know, sort of easier commercial sources of starch. We don't eat it anymore. My friend Suzanne Masters, who is also an ethnobotanist, is doing her PhD on this subject because they still use it in Turkey. And she's interested in, you know, the wild harvesting of the orchid tubers, bulbs probably, and whether that's having an effect or what effect that's having on the world population.
Yeah.
But they make it into ice cream. You just think, how cool would that be? So we've got to have some. So, yeah.
That's interesting.
I know.
What's often occurred to me, I've done some survival training and I've done expeditions to like Nova Scotia and stuff like that. And what's always been a real feature and notable is how much time, if you're on a subsistence level, it takes you to collect food, firewood, etc., etc. And
yes.
It is incredible to me how people, you know, who are doing subsistence farming or hunter gathering or whatever, how much time it takes just to keep body and soul together.
Yes, and of course they worked in groups.
Yeah.
Tribes or family groups, and you need that spirit of cooperation that we don't really have now. We're all very sort of individually focused. Yeah. We're small family units and stuff like that. There's a plant that the Native Americans used a lot that's called Camassia, and that's another sort of starchy root. Again, I think it's probably a bulb. And not only did you have to collect it, but to make it edible, you had to slow roast it in a pit for hours.
Right.
You say, yes, I'd like to try it. Probably I'd like to grow it. But am I likely then to process it to the point where I could eat it? I think, no, probably not.
No.
And it is the sort of carbohydrate part of the diet, which is really, really hard and time-consuming to find. If you're, as you say, if you're living off the land, that's the one that you're going to have a problem with.
Yeah, because it's not as energy dense as some of the other stuff you can get through keeping livestock and stuff like that.
No, exactly.
And there's a lot of the starches that need soaking or whatever in order to get rid of the toxins as well, isn't it? So the process of either grating them or leaving them in a bag and leaving them in the river so that the stuff washes through. I mean, it's incredible how much time is taken to process that.
And how much knowledge there is as well.
Yeah.
Of the people that process them, because I think it's cassava that originated in the Amazon. The people there have got, you know, long-held ways of processing it to get rid of the poisons, and it got taken to Africa, And the Africans have their way of processing it as well, but it's not as effective as the one that they used in the Amazon. So you have far more cases of poisoning in Africa than you do. And also, it's probably an interaction with the ecosystem as well, because the rest of the diet in the Amazon would include different plants and the soil's different. So you get that different mineral balance, which can offset some of the toxicity. Sorry, this is an ethnobotany topic.
No, it's very interesting.
So it's a bit nerdy. But yes. So you can't, it's not entirely possible to extract a plant from one place and grow it in another and use it in exactly the same way and get exactly the same effect. Right, it's quite a complicated process.
It's context dependent.
It is, very much, yeah.
Excellent. That's a very interesting way of looking at it. So the things that we eat, where we grow them out of their natural habitat, we're not eating, getting the same thing, because the environment, the medium that we grow them in is different, and the things that we eat with them are different, and so we're actually going to be getting a different experience and different nutrition from them in many cases.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at okra, but also potatoes as well, in the Andes they have hundreds if not thousands of varieties, and they are planted in different places, they grow in different microclimates, and they are used in different ways. They have a variety of okra and a variety of potato, probably more than one, which is grown, has been bred to be freeze-dried and naturally freeze-dried on the side of an Andean mountain.
Right.
And so when you look at the, you know, how they're used in their native lands and try and import that here, it doesn't always work, because we can't have the same varieties. Okra is day length sensitive as well.
Yep.
And a lot of them won't happily grow here. And the ones we've got, we don't know what they were originally used for.
Right.
So we have to experiment and see how we want to use them, because we can't necessarily do what they would have done in the Andes with them.
Yeah.
Because we don't know.
Right. One thing I have to get you to do, Emma, is, because you've used the term a couple of times now, and some people may not understand what that means. What does day length sensitive mean?
Oh gosh, you need a botany expert.
You'll have to make do with the two of us.
Have to cobble together some
hard luck.
Basically, plants react to the length of days. They have hormones just like us, and various events in their life cycle are triggered by the length of the day. In actual fact, it's the length of the night that they respond to. But we call it day length sensitivity. And so it depends on the plant and where it's come from. But something like okra, it is waiting for a specific length of day to trigger the production of its storage tubers, the part that we would normally eat.
Right.
So it's waiting for the right period in the year, which is triggered by the length of the day. Now, of course, the lengths of day in the Andes is very different to ours. We get very, very long days and short nights in summer, and very, very short days and long nights in the winter. Yeah. And a lot of the plants that we grow are adapted to that. That's normal for them. But the ones we import from other places, they're like, hang on a minute, I don't know what time of year it is. What's going on? I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. So the plant is horribly, horribly confused.
So it's sort of the plant equivalent of jet lag.
Yeah, it is very much. It's like, but it doesn't, that particular plant can't adapt. The adaptation process for plants is quite a long one. The potato would have suffered from this problem when it first arrived. And it would have been people trial and error, getting varieties that were less day length sensitive than others, and breeding, and, you know, selecting out the plants that work best. And over time, the potato has gone, oh yeah, this is the UK, I know exactly what's going on here. And if you took it back to the Andes, it would go like, what? Right. Where? How? So, you know, we get over jet lag in maybe a couple of weeks, but with plants, it takes a bit longer than that.
Right. So they're waiting for evolution and breeding to sort it out rather than
the
natural system. Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, that's a brilliant explanation of that. Thinking about survival training as I was going on.
Yeah.
If you were on the desert island and you were talking to your desert island discs person, and they said, okay, you can only have one unusual edible for your desert island to keep you going. Which would it be and why?
Oh, this is interesting because it plays right to the heart of what is an unusual edible. It's a very individual term. What's unusual to me won't be unusual to everybody else. It depends when you were born, where you were born, what you eat on a regular basis. It's interesting that we talk about desert islands, because if it really was a desert, you wouldn't get anything at all.
Indeed not.
But I think I'm going to cheat and I'm going to choose a plant that would be very unusual for me, but probably wouldn't be very unusual for the island. And I'm going to go with a coconut.
Aha, yep.
Because a very, very, very useful plant. You can use all kinds of bits of the plant to do various things. So I could build my shelter. I'd have lots of fiber. And, of course, I've got nice coconut meat and coconut milk, which is yummy.
Yeah.
I've probably got big leaves and things like that. So I would choose the coconut.
Excellent.
It is my unusual plant. But you maybe wouldn't consider it an unusual edible if you were seeing it on the island.
No, so you could have your coconut fibre skirt or trousers. We could use the shells and we could do horse impressions, if nothing else, couldn't we?
That's the entertainment sort.
Yes. Oh, it's going to be a really dramatic life out there. And we could ferment the coconut juice.
Yes, we could.
So you don't have to be alcohol free.
No.
And there's all sorts of things we can do with the meat. That's excellent.
Yeah. And we'll have a few. So we've got timber as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Excellent. You know how you propagate the coconut? So if you
No, I know that they float and that they wash up on the shore and then they germinate. So maybe I'll sort of arrive on a raft that's just got coconuts hanging over the edge. So they've been sitting in the salt water and then just like plonk them on the beach and let them do their thing. No, I'd have to investigate.
Excellent. Well, that's a bit of homework for
How does one grow a coconut?
Excellent. Well, Emma, thanks ever so much for taking the time to do this interview. I really enjoyed it.
And I hope
those that are listening have enjoyed it as well. If you're listening and you want to get a copy of Jade Pearls and Alien Eyeballs, it's available from Smashwords, it's available from the Barnes & Noble Nook store, and both the US and UK iTunes stores. Important, it's only $2.99 before the 1st of May. After that, it goes up to the grand price of $3.99. Yeah. So it's a real bargain. It's packed full of interesting and inspiring stuff. Follow the links on my blog page or visit Emma's blog at emmacooper.org/blog. Hope you've all enjoyed listening. Goodbye.